Welcome, guys. We're well along in our series on 21st century marriage, and today we're going to look at the topic of conflict. We've chosen two distinct words, words that everyone of us is familiar with. Those words are quarreling and conflict. I think sometimes we enter into marriage, and while we do understand that there will be minor disagreements, we're really not prepared for some of the significant differences in viewpoint, in practice, in values that we might uncover. Now, if the courting process was extensive, and I use that word courting, I've used it before, and I know that's sort of out of vogue and maybe unfamiliar to many of you, but courting, as we've said, is that process of determining the character, the load-withstanding ability of another individual. And since many of us have entered into marriage without a real courting process, we can be very surprised by what we find once we're 3 or 5 or 10 years into a marriage. And we're shocked sometimes at the significant differences that we have from our spouse in the way we'd approach things, in what we believe is the best course of action for things, even sometimes in what is the right or the wrong thing, not just a course of action, but literally what is the wrong or the right behind the course of action. Well, how do we resolve those conflicts? And then just as importantly, when we can't resolve those conflicts, what do we do? Are we equipped to live with that tension, to embrace each other with love, with understanding? Or do we get into the alternative phase, which is what the scriptures describe as quarreling, where we become petty and divisive and almost seek, if not overtly intentionally, then at some subsurface level, seek to undermine the good of the other person, almost seek to destroy the good that they want to do and they the good that we want to do? Well, we don't want to get to that. As a matter of fact, many of the biblical writers have a lot to say about how the outside world watches us and what their assumptions are when they see us behaving, well, sometimes we might want to call it childishly. So I think that some of the scriptures that we're going to look at this morning and some of the understandings that we'll uncover will be helpful to every couple as they look at how to respectfully, carefully handle the disagreements that come into any long-standing relationship. Look forward to seeing you again next week. I hope you're blessed by this week's podcast. Meanwhile, I want to put a couple of words up on the board. No, it is not, but thanks for checking. So the first word is disagree. And we're going to divide that in half. I want to introduce two additional words. Quarrel is the first, and then conflict is the next. So this morning is going to be, I guess we'll say, equal parts of information and reflection. So some of what we're going to talk about this morning is not going to be particularly new or exciting information to you. But what I hope it's going to cause us to do when we pull all this together is cause us to look at ourselves. Am I this person? Am I the person that's being described in these situations here? So a little bit of background on 2 Timothy here. This is perhaps one of the last letters that Paul writes. It's certainly one of the last recorded letters that we have. Obviously, he's writing to Timothy. He's in jail again, probably. And time is very short for him. It's that word that we use a lot when we talk about, for instance, the second coming of Christ, where we say it's imminent. Imminent means could happen today. It could happen 10 years from now, but it can happen at any moment. And so Paul is prepared for that. So think about what you would do if you had invested your life as a planter of churches and you knew your time was short. What are the things that you would say to the person that you had invested the most in, what would you say to the person that you had mentored and who was going to carry on your work? Time is short. You're going to write everything. You're not going to have a face-to-face conversation over which, you know, you can't linger over coffee and spend half a day together. It's just some words that Paul's going to write here. And I introduce all that so that when you read these words and the next time you go through this book, you understand them in a completely different way. This is a very personal, very intimate letter. And sometimes I don't think we pick up on that. So here Paul begins. It's not an uncommon greeting that he uses. Paul, an apostle of Jesus Christ, by the will of God, and according to the promise of the life that is in Christ. So I have a call from God. I am an apostle, which means I am an outspoken representative of, and the very thing that I am representing is this gospel. And Timothy knows all that that means. And then he launches into a little bit of stuff that at first, if you don't understand this backdrop that I just introduced, it's kind of nice. But I want you to think about it in these terms. This may be the last time that he ever writes anything to Timothy. I thank God, whom I serve as did my ancestors, as I remember you constantly in my prayers, day and night. And I remember your tears, and I long to see you, that I may be filled with joy. I am reminded of your sincere faith. And then jump down. I am sure that it dwells in you as well. For this reason, I remind you to fan into flame the gift of God which is in you through the laying on of the hands. For God gave us a spirit, not of fear, but of power and love and of self-control. And you may have something like a sound mind. If you have a pen, write those words down. The secret to overcoming fear, he suggests, the opportunity to overcome fear is found in the three things that God has made available to us through His Spirit, but which we may choose not to avail ourselves of. So if you can imagine this idea, if you had $1,000 in your wallet, and yet you went around scrounging for food, you walked because you felt you didn't have money to put gas in your tank, and this is kind of the way we live sometimes. Here's what Paul is saying. These things are available to you, Tim. Why does he tell him that? Because it's our human tendency not to avail ourselves completely of the things that God puts into us and makes available to us. Not a spirit of fear, but of power. What does that mean? I have a God-given authority. I don't need to cave in. Maybe it would be helpful if we introduce another component of this letter. Why is Paul in prison? For speaking about this word, about this very gospel. This is about the time that there is some significant persecution going to begin to occur in the church. This is during the time of Nero, probably, and there are very soon, the Christians are going to be the scapegoats for all of the problems that Rome is experiencing. It's almost like us as Christians today, right? If there's a problem in this country, it's because what? We're the fanaticals that are creating these problems. And what he's saying is, Tim, my time is short, but you're going to live for a while yet. And you have a choice. You can either stand boldly and confidently and continue to represent this gospel that we have invested our lives in, or, well, what's the alternative? Live in fear and live in retreat. So here's what he says. God has given you this spirit of authority, of power. That's not arrogance. It's different. And of love. Now that's an interesting combination. If you were to be making stew here, and it was an emotional stew, power and love, how do the two of them relate? Authority and love. How do the two of them relate?
They only really relate in a Christian context, or like to us today. You know, mostly power is you're going to do what I'm saying. They can pick dictatorships and this kind of thing. Christ introduced the idea of a servant leader, and that's a whole different thing. You know, it's not, you know, what's wrong with coppers today? Well, they're padding their pockets and selling us out. There's no servanthood.
2 minutes of conversation. Right away, you got to go to Washington with it, right? No, don't introduce those words. We're not going there this morning.
That is a good picture. Well, if you want to be political, because the original politicians really served.
Yes.
They really served. And we see a difference today. So, the model is Jesus Christ, and that's revolutionary. That's radical.
All right, so in the context of what he's saying is, in the face of this opposition that you're going to face, in the face of the perhaps persecution that you're going to face, God has given you the ability to stand firm. To stand firm, why? Because you actually care about the people you're trying to help. See, if you're just standing firm because you're this, and we're going to get to that in a moment. If you're just standing firm because you don't want to be wrong, if you're standing firm because you have a vested interest in being right all the time, that's altogether different than standing firm on a principle of I love you and I want to do what is best for you. Even if, and why is Paul in prison? Because he's acting in the best interest of others. If Paul was acting and using this authority and this power for his own good, where would he be? I guarantee he wouldn't be in prison. And then finally, this third component, self-control. So power, authority, mixed with a concern for others, moderated by knowing when to speak up and when to shut up. That's a very important component of quarrel. And that's what self-control or a sound mind means. It means that you don't leave your intellect. As a matter of fact, the Spirit of God brings your intellect fully alive and helps you to have discernment so as to recognize when is the right time to speak and what are the right words to say versus when is the right time to say nothing and be silent. All right, jump down to verse 8. And we just want to bring this whole tension right to the top so that there's no misunderstanding about it. Therefore, do not be ashamed of the testimony about our Lord, nor of me as prisoner. Why does he have to say that? Because all around him there is a swirl of controversy. Look, if your God is so great, Tim, and if this gospel that you represent is so marvelous, then why is the guy who mentored you, developed you, went before you, why is he in jail right now if this God of yours is so great? Do you think that's a question that was never asked? Do you think that's just a question? Why do bad things happen to good people? Do you think that question originated in the 20th century? Probably not. It goes all the way back to that time. And so he's saying, Tim, there's going to be a lot of people that are going to call this into question. Don't be ashamed. Don't be ashamed of the fact that I'm in jail. Don't be embarrassed for me and don't be embarrassed about this message. I'm in a bad situation for a good reason. And we'll move over to chapter 2, which is actually where I wanted to get to. But this was all introduction, incidentally. So now that everything has been introduced, now we can get into where we wanted to go. You then, my child, and again, that is a very strong term of endearment. That's why I say this is such a personal letter. Be strengthened by the grace that is in Christ Jesus. And what you've heard from me in the presence of many witnesses, and trust to faithful men. We know that stuff, so we're going to jump down here. Let's start at verse 8. Remember Christ Jesus, risen from the dead, the offspring of David, as preached in my gospel, for which I am suffering, bound with chains as a criminal. That's the backdrop. Move over to verse 14. So now he moves from, Tim, I wanted to talk to you personally about how you should respond. Now there's a transition. Let me tell you some of the things that you need to remember as you deal with the people who are the church. The last thing that Paul would want to have happen is for all he had sacrificed and all he had given up to see his work undone. Think about if you had all day and all the time in the world on your hands. What would you think about if you had poured your life into being a church planter and now you were out of the loop? You couldn't be out there. You couldn't do the work anymore. The best you could do is communicate with some other people and hope that they would stand firm. Where would your mind go to on bad days and dark hours? Come on, this shouldn't take much imagination. That within a generation, everything that we have built might fall apart. Because while Paul clearly recognizes the power of God, he's also in prison because of the power of man. So he recognizes there's a battle going on here. There is the authority and the power of God, which demonstrates itself in love. And when the authority of love meets the power of Rome, there's going to be a conflict. And in any conflict, there's going to be a winner and there's going to be a loser. And so in those dark personal moments, have you ever known the truth about God and doubted it? Have you ever known the truth and known what you should believe and yet still struggled to believe it in a moment of darkness? And that doesn't take all that long, right? That's not a year-long journey. That can be a five-second journey from I know what I believe, I know I'm confident in this, to oh my. Right? And all that stuff going through Paul's mind, and this is why he writes this. Remind them. And the them is the elect, the chosen, which he describes just a few verses before that. Remind them of these things and charge them before God. Now, this is his first explanation of what Tim should do to keep the church going strong. Look at what he says. Charge them before God not to quarrel about words, which does no good, but only what? What's your translation say? Ruins or destroys those who listen. Here's a question for you. How does a quarrel destroy the hearer? How does quarreling destroy you or your wife? Maybe I should have reminded you that we are still in a marriage series. But this topic relates to so much more than marriage. Bob?
Well, I'm like an athletic competition in a quarrel, no one wins. Not ever. If it becomes an entity on its own, a quarrel can just sit there. Me and my wife can step away from it and step right back into it. It's like having an extra room on the house. It would ruin because it's such a distraction. You can always go back to that and we become uncomfortable or our familiar territory that we easily can visit.
Okay.
So I'm finished with it.
Needs a few minor training, huh?
So what do you think people divide you who are supposed to be one? So it's like dividing your own career.
Ooh, we're going to come back to that. Anything else? Well, if we pick up on what Brian said, once the quarreling begins, how long does it take? Let's say 6 months go by and you let that whole thing dormant. How long does it take once you revisit that topic before it's back into full-blown argument? It's a trigger, isn't it? Now, do you remember what we said? And it's further down in your notes, but do you remember what we said about the difference between the way men and women remember things? How does a woman remember things? Based on? And the way she was feeling. And it means that, have you ever had this experience? You're trying to have a linear discussion. We'll say it's a discussion about something that you disagree on with your wife. One topic. Has the discussion ever gotten to be like a spider web? This is connected to that, which means that and that. And it's like, no. We were talking about the mortgage payment. No, what does that have to do with Junior's college education? The mortgage, and then it's when we're going to have time to visit our in-laws and this and that and the other thing. Why? Because she remembers everything that she felt at the time of the single discussion. It reminds her of all the other negative impressions she had about the other discussions. And so what happens? It's not only the person that's ruined, but what is the hope that that's ever going to be resolved? Once you get to that level, turn over with me to Proverbs 17:14. And this one is actually worth turning to, I think. All right, I'm assuming most of you are there. So here it is in my translation. The beginning of strife is like letting out water. So quit before the quarrel breaks out.
17:14. Is that what you said?
Yeah. Okay. Let me read it again. The beginning of strife is like letting out water. So quit before the quarrel breaks out. All right, so this is a guy thing, so I'll ask this question. Have any of you ever, do you remember back to the days when cars used to actually overheat and you had problems? Have any of you ever had a car that was overheating and you knew you needed to add coolant and you were along the side of the road and you thought, well, you know, I probably should give it more time to cool off, but let me just pop the cap. And there's the initial burst of steam, right, which you were prepared for. It's not the burst of steam. So assuming you didn't burn your hand, assuming you were smart enough to have a rag or something when you took that off so you didn't scald your hand beyond recognition from the initial burst of steam, what comes next? There's this tumultuous uproar like a volcano of what's left of the coolant in there. Have you ever had the spur of the moment thought, I think I'll put the cap back on? How does that work? Or maybe you've done this. Maybe you've had a plumbing line that was under pressure and you thought, you didn't have a valve to shut it off and you thought, well, I'll just unthread this. I'll be able to thread it back on afterwards. Have you ever tried to thread a cap back onto a line when it's under pressure? It's like, how does that work? See, you have tried to do that, haven't you?
I have to.
Me too. Do you see what he's saying? Be discerning about how you disagree, because some things, once they erupt, are going to have to run their full course. You're not going to be able to put the stopper back in. You're not going to be able to shut this down. Now, what's the full course of an aggressive disagreement? What does that look like in your house? Okay, I won't ask you to use the words that take place in your house. I just ask you what it looks like. It was a joke. You can laugh. Does anything get accomplished? Or do you hope that it all cools off within 2 or 3 days? And then maybe you can revisit it. So do you realize what he's asking? What Solomon is saying here in this proverb? He's saying, you know, maybe it would be better if you didn't take it to that level. Now, what is inside of us that prompts us to push and to prod and to move forward? And we all know when we've crossed the line. We know it. We know where it's going. There's a point. Up to that point, it could be a civil discussion, but we know the word. The word that's responded to by the look, that comes with the long pause before that first word from the combatant, which is your wife. Those are synonymous terms at times.
Well, you're talking about being constructive or destructive. Usually when it turns into personal, you never, and we become attacking. We cross that line, like you said, and we make it personal in the conflict. You can be blamed for something. I guess maybe no one does that.
All right. Move back over to Romans 14th chapter. Now, at first, this is not going to seem like it's relevant to what we're talking about. He's talking to people who are believers. And he's talking to people who are believers who hold their opinions strongly. They hold their beliefs in high esteem. What do you think of other people who disagree with you about things that are extremely important to you? Let's be honest. Okay, we might not say that, although sometimes we do.
How can they not get this?
Oh, see? Did you hear him? The passion's coming to his voice right now, just describing that. Perhaps he's had a discussion like that once or twice in his life.
With the guy who's left.
But here's what Paul says. As for the one who is weak in the faith, welcome him, but not to quarrel over opinions. One person believes he may eat anything, while the next person believes he eats only vegetables. Let not the one who eats despise the one who abstains, and let not the one who abstains pass judgment on the one who eats. So what is one of the first responses that occurs when we get together with people? We hold our own position closely, and the other person holds a different position. What are the two responses? Or, what? Look at the word that he uses. There you go. Don't pass judgment. Well, what kind of judgment am I going to pass on that person based on the context of this?
Maybe a little unkind.
Well, now I'm going to move from a disagreement about a thing to questioning your character. Now that becomes a personal assault. You're obviously not as holy as I am. Well, you're obviously not as clear-thinking as I am. So you must be three generations inbred and can't think correctly. And the other side? Very clearly, you're not the man or the woman of God that I thought you were. Because if you were, you'd think this way. Remember what Scott said when he introduced this? And he said that there's a conflict. There's the thing that we disagree about, and there's a person here and a person there, and pretty soon the thing that we disagree about is pushed to the side, and it's just a battle between two people. This is what very shortly happens when I don't practice discernment, and pretty soon I'm judging other people instead of dealing with the issue. All right, we're back to 1 Timothy now.
On that Romans 14, First Timothy is talking about the action.
Well, as a matter of fact, I'll tell you what. Since we're probably not going to get to all this, some of this is material that was left over from the camping weekend. Turn over to the last page. About halfway down the page, it says, we have conflict over...
You're on the second page?
I'm on what would be the... Well, it's the second page for you. Yeah, it's the front side of the second page, right?
Yeah.
Right below the three sources of conflict, the next one is, we have conflict over our expectations. And this next one is big, our values. So what is Paul describing in that text in Romans? It's a values judgment. This is an important way that I demonstrate my devotion to God, my worship toward God. I eat or don't eat this. I do or don't do that. I drink or don't drink this. This is important to me. Have you ever had values conflicts with another person? And we can come back to this. Remember, this is another important component that we should write down. All of this conflict that we have occurs because we share something in common. And this is where, if you were on the camping trip, I apologize, some of this is going to be redundant. But we can't have conflict with someone whom we don't share anything with. So understand what you share with that person that brings you together and unites you. Because it's out of that unitedness that the conflict spurs. But do you care about what happens to somebody that you've never met before, don't know, and none of their interests and your interests overlap? You never give them a second thought. It's only the people whose interests and your interests overlap that you will ever have conflict with. So understand what you have in common. And then the next thing, after our values, our trust of the person with whom we're having the conflict. So now when I start to move from I don't eat this and you do, I don't drink this and you do, and I start to make judgments, now I make a judgment about what kind of person you are then. And Paul's saying, don't do that. But once I've made that judgment about what kind of person you are, can I trust anything else that you say? Do you understand what I'm saying here? Once I have crossed that threshold and said, you are clearly not the man or the woman of God that I thought you were, therefore, I'm not sure if I can trust anything else that you say, anything else that you tell me, anything else that you stand for. Because obviously your thinking is clouded. From that moment on, there's always going to be a certain level of superiority that you will hold because you believe that somehow you have a better, clearer understanding of right and wrong than that other person does. Let me give you five sources of conflict here that you can write down. They're not in your notes. And we've talked about a couple of them already. Number one is superiority. I think I know and you don't. I think I have a better understanding than you. So, since Brian has already introduced the political scene into this morning's discussion, I don't feel that I would be the first one entering the water. Therefore, I don't feel guilty anymore. Okay. Is it really true that everybody who goes to Washington to work soon abandons their interest in what's good for the people of this country? Or is it true instead that they both want what they believe is best for people, but they have significantly different approaches? You're shaking your head no. What?
No, you gotta continue.
Okay. Most of the people that go there, yes, their interests are divided. Of course they want to get reelected. You want to keep your job too. So we're not going to necessarily hold that against them. Most of the people that go there, I think, have some desire to serve the people. But how they go about doing it is significantly different. So I can want to serve the people, and someone else can want to serve the people, and yet we both see the way to get to that objective, the way to get to that end, significantly differently.
It's also the people who choose to serve.
It is that.
I want to serve these people, I want to serve these people, and now you're clashing because you don't want that guy to serve those people, and vice versa.
You know, there's this cup of coffee magically appeared here. I don't know where that came from. But was that you, Scott? Was it? Good. How did you get up here and I didn't even notice that? Okay. So here's the first source, superiority. Number two, injustice. So I think that in some way you have taken advantage of me. I have been victimized by something. Ties in closely with number three, which is vulnerability. I feel open and exposed. can't be truthful in a situation. I can't be honest and candid in a situation because I feel weak. And when I don't trust your character, how can I dare reveal my weakness? How can we ever possibly have a legitimate, serious conversation that may lead to solutions if I can't be completely forthcoming with what I'm thinking or what I'm experiencing? And I can't do that because I now don't trust your character any longer. Which is number four, distrust. And the final one is helplessness. When I completely despair of something, and when I feel helpless, there will be this overwhelming emotion that will take hold, and I'm either going to shrink back into basically self-destruction, I will do self-destructive things, or I will lash out. So what happens when you corner an animal? Some cower in fear, but some don't, right? Maybe a couple of you have scars that remind you of the fact that not all animals cower in fear. All right, now let's turn over to 1 Timothy. Sixth chapter. We're going to start at the beginning of the chapter just because this preface will help us to understand the context in which Paul's talking. Let all who are under a yoke as bondservants regard their own masters as worthy of all honor. Why? So that the name of God and His teaching may not be reviled. Now, this letter is written, obviously, previous to 2 Timothy. It's written at a different time, but it's not so far removed from this situation. Christian and their character are being assaulted. Nothing unusual about that, believe me, nothing unusual about that. Anything you see happening in this country in the 21st century has all happened before, and a lot worse. Those who have believing masters must not be disrespectful on the grounds that they are brothers. Rather, they must serve all the better, since those who benefit by their good service are believers and beloved. So today we translate this, and in some parts of the world we really could say slave and slaveholder. But today in this country we'd say employer and employee. Have you ever had harsh words about your employer? Okay, what do employers say about employees? What do employees say about employers? Come on.
Employers say employees don't work hard enough. We say employers don't appreciate.
Don't appreciate, don't pay, don't this. And so what do? Paul already knows what they do. They start to take matters into their own hands, right? Well, if you're not going to pay me this much, I'm not going to work so hard. And that validates in the employer's mind, see, I knew you were a lazy slug. Right? And it's a self-reinforcing cycle. So in the light of that, where he says, listen, don't behave like that. All you're doing, in the end, is allowing your critics to castigate God and this gospel. See, it's those Christians. Those Christians just make trouble. He said, just ignore the slight if you need to. Now, we move down to the next verse. Teach and urge these things. If anyone teaches a different doctrine and does not agree with the sound words of our Lord Jesus Christ, in other words, there are people that are disagreeing with this. There are people that are saying, you know, if you're the slave, you just need to stand up for your rights. Walk off the job, if you will. Whatever it is. So, does not agree with these sound words of our Lord Jesus Christ and the teachings that accords with godliness, he is puffed up with conceit and understands nothing. Now, these next words, now this is the source, the start of real conflict. He has an unhealthy craving for controversy. This is where we get into this word quarrel. Be honest. Does a good argument over nothing delight you? Are there times when you just feel like getting in a dig about something? Just for the sake of it. Feels good, doesn't it? It's kind of like chess, except you never need to put the board away. And it's always there. It's always ready to be set up and played at any given moment. Are you that kind of a person? We have people in the church, in this country, who are specialists at finding fault with other people in the church, in this country. One faction opposes another faction, says they're not as righteous, they're not as holy, they don't believe this the right way, they don't believe that the right way. And here's the thing, and this is a profound question. Are you more interested in critiquing other people or in living your own life properly? Do you make it your business to go around finding fault with other people, which is the starting point of a quarrel? You're not doing this well. You're not handling that right. You don't believe the right way. You don't have the right doctrine. You don't have this. That's the start of a quarrel. Is it easier for you to find fault with other people or to live your own life the right way? That's not a trick question, but honestly, what's easier? I can always find chinks in somebody else's armor, can't you? It's really easy. Look at the way this plays out. Craving for controversy and for quarrels about words, which produces envy, dissension, slander, evil suspicions, and constant friction among people. You know, that happens in houses. That happens in marriages. Where what starts out is, remember we said about that distrust, one of the factors that produces significant conflict? Where at first, there's legitimate disagreement, and it leads to heated discussion. But over a period of time, and I think this is human nature, and I think this is what we do. If we disagree with someone, and we express our disagreement, and we can't get resolution that satisfies us, and the disagreement, the tension is there all the time, what do we start to do? You can no longer talk about the thing that's really the big issue, so what do you do? You don't talk about anything is one thing, but what's the other thing?
Another fault.
Oh, you come on. Yes, you do, right? Lots of them, right? Okay, I really disagree with you about this thing. It's that big. It takes up the whole living room. That's the size of this disagreement. But we can never deal with that satisfactorily. So I'm going to find this little fault, this. You ever done that? Okay, me and one other person are the only people in the room that have apparently done that. Okay, there's three of us now. That's good. Look at this train of things that this produces. This quarrels. Envy, dissension, slander. Where's the slander take you to? Turn over to... would be the backside of your first page. Principle number three. The enemy of my opponent becomes my friend. And the secondary principle there that's not written but you need to write down is my friend becomes my enemy's opponent. What happens when you can't get resolution to this big thing that goes on in your marriage? If you're not careful, you'll find allies, right? You have a major disagreement with your wife. You can't do anything about that. Sorry, Justin, I'm doing the circular thing again. So who are you going to talk to? You want to be right. Don't we all want to be right? It seems to be an inbred thing in us. We want to be right. As a matter of fact, one of the things that I wrote there is that a man sometimes equates being recognized as right with being respected. You're looking at me quizzically, but think about that. So when your rightness is challenged by your spouse, how do you feel? I mean, let's face it, you've invested 20, 30, 40 years in drawing this conclusion, this opinion, this line of reasoning about something. And your wife is now challenging and you saying, I think you're wrong. What does that say about you? What does that say to you about you? So where do you go with that? Where do you go with the tension that comes from being felt wrong when the one person that you probably should go to, your wife, is the one person you can't go to? Come on, this is not hard to think through. Where do you go? You find allies. You find people who think the same way you do. And you start to talk with the people who think the way you do about the people who don't think the way you do, which in this case is who? Your wife. Does this ever happen? No, it doesn't, Justin says. No, he's saying that with all sincerity. And isn't that what starts to be slander? So now I've taken this disagreement that was between two of us, and I can't find an ally in my wife, so I go outside that loop and I find an ally out there, and I start to discuss the thing with her, with that person. Scott.
Typically, when you go to that other person, you're not confining the entire truth on the argument of the conflict. You're gaining an ally to support yourself instead of finding a neutral party to help you become selfless. I mean, I have relatives that are going through a divorce. And now they have, each one of them has gone to other family members to gain some kind of a support group. And I'm listening both at a neutral area, because I can really give a rip. But what I hear on one side, and I hear from the other side, you might think they were in two different countries, let alone married to each other, because that's how different the stories are. But each one is gaining their little army of confidants to support their own needs. Which is, then when the two of them, the divorce is not finalized, come together, that just makes it so much worse. Because now there is even more aggression, more anger, more hate, more hurtfulness that takes place. So the conflict, that never goes away, it just gets worse.
Well, you're talking about when I'm gathering that group of support, not only am I not honest to them, they're not really being honest back to me. You know, but they're, oh yeah, you know, this and that. I see it and I believe it. And they're only like that front of me. They wouldn't be like that in front of my wife. You know, like, I mean, it's dishonesty all around, for the most part, where it can be very quickly, you know, just an omission. Like you're saying, you know, I'm omitting my faults in it. Everyone's seeing just her problems in it. Like, that's not balanced or honest.
But they're being honest with you because of the truth, of your side of the truth. It takes a real man to stand up and admit his faults in a divorce or in a conflict. But you have to be really secure with yourself and be able to really look at yourself in the mirror and say, you know what, I'm at least 50% blame for this. At the very least 50%. If not more. So all these people are going to jump on her bandwagon or your bandwagon because you're spinning your truth. But are you really the truth, or are you just saying your little story to get your little bandwagon people behind you? Because nobody wants to be alone. Nobody wants to face this alone.
Well, come back to the Romans thing. Were the people that believed one way about food drink wrong, and the people that believed the other way right? Paul doesn't seem to imply that at all. And yet it was very clearly a major conflict between groups of people, so that there wasn't necessarily a right and a wrong. All right, we've done a great job of mapping out what can happen. So now what I'd like to do, before we move on, is think about, what do we do to change this? So in community here, how do we help each other? And as individuals, before we even move out into community, what do we do about this tension that exists in this conflict? Or what don't we do?
Well,
What is the promise that we make? Remember that one of the things that contributes to conflict is a lack of trust. So if my wife suspects that when we have this, I'm going to go outside and I'm going to have conversations with people who will be my allies, what's she going to do? The exact same thing. And your allies are going to validate your opinion, and her allies are going to naturally validate her opinion, depending on the kind of allies. And so that's going to reinforce your position and reinforce her position. Well, if you were pretty resolved in your opinion and she and hers before you went out and found allies, how much more resolved are you going to be in your opinion now? What are you doing? You're ensuring that there'll never be a solution to this. So the question is that the way we want to live, or do we need to find another way to deal with this stuff? Because this is the reality of most marriages. There are things that you will have significant disagreements about. There's no question about it. So what do we do for each other to help each other?
When I look at that illustration, it reminds me...
It's a bad illustration, I know that.
It reminds me of like the plank in the eye of the sawdust. And it's like, until you deal with the plank, why are you not picking sawdust out of somebody else's eye? So you have to look within and deal with your own issue. Or deal with why you're making that an issue. That might not even be the issue. That just might prompt the idea.
That doesn't look very plankish.
Like you said, ball. You didn't say right or wrong.
No, that looks worse.
Like you said, ball. You didn't say right or wrong, but you did say, here's what's above and beyond all, just the law of love for one another. That's what he was talking about there. And that's how we're going to deal with it. But in our minds, there has to be a right, there has to be a wrong. There can't be two rights and two wrongs.
That's very difficult. And yet, remember what we started. It's interesting that John brought that up. What were the three things that Paul introduced to Timothy? I asked you to write them down. The first was authority.
Power, love, and self-control.
There you go. See how pertinent that is to this? So if I have God's assurance that for me this thing is right, but I also have love for the other person, and I trust the other person, and God may be saying something different to them based on who they are and their situation, then can I have the discernment, the sound mind, to say, maybe this is an area where we can accept each other while we don't at this moment agree with each other. Scott.
To that point, the trust element, that is so important, because until you dig down deep and make yourself vulnerable enough to say, I'm going to share what I really feel or what I really think, and not kind of like what you want to hear, that trust is lacking. It's a little weak. So I think it really begins with yourself, to put yourself out in the middle of the bullseye and say, I'm opening up, here I am. You know, it's kind of like when you confess your sins to God and say, I'm a sinner. I've done wrong. I need forgiveness. It's the same thing in a relationship, whatever, it's with a friend, if it's with your wife, whomever. Until you really become totally honest, with who you are and what you want, there's always a little bit of question mark in the other person's mind, which is always going to be a source of this conflict. So, kind of look at yourself when you're in the midst of this tornado of a conflict and resolution.
Justin was talking about it. If I'm not man enough, let's just say, to say things about circumstances, I'm not waiting you guys to be honest back to me about it. You know, if I'm someone purposely being blinded to something, it's very hard to approach the subject with them. So if I say, you know, I really messed things up with my wife, you know, in the midst of all the conflict and stuff, gives John a chance to say, well, you know, there's a way to work on that. Or maybe can improve. I have to invite you guys to walk with me and be really, you know, to speak the truth in love to me.
Mm-hmm.
To actually be better than just to, you know, in my corner, getting my shoulders rubbed and the cut fixed and getting ready for round two. Because that's going to go, that will ruin it.
That's a great illustration, because isn't that sometimes what we find friends to do? Right? We go out and we find some friend that's going to bolster us, get us ready so that we can go back into the conflict again. Now, in community, then, we have our personal responsibility, but how do we in community behave? So in other words, when someone comes to me, what is my responsibility? Do I become their personal ally? See, I can't do that. I need to remain neutral. That's difficult, isn't it? Because when a person comes to you, they're coming with the emotion, the passion, the sense of right, the sense of being victimized maybe, the sense that they've taken abuse for something that they shouldn't, and they're looking for what? They're not looking for what you should give them. Yes. And here's the thing. I think we do that a lot. So if we want to keep healthy marriages, I guess what I'm saying is we have to help each other by remaining neutral about certain things and helping people to take responsibility for their own relationships and work through them.
Yes is yes. No is no. That's kind of what God says. When I say yes, it means yes. When I say no, it means no. And if you just do what God says, you can't go wrong. So somebody was just telling me the other day, somebody has a problem, I say, what does God's Word say? I don't get involved. I don't make a decision. What does God's Word say? That's what I give. It's kind of hurt. It's kind of a little bit insensitive at times, but it's the truth. It keeps me out of it. It keeps me out of it, uninvolved. And it gives them the right answer. So that's kind of what you're saying. Be neutral. Let God give the answer.
Let me come back to the verses here in 2 Timothy in the second chapter. As a matter of fact, maybe you want to come back to them as well. Second chapter. We'll start at verse 22. And I know we've used these verses for some other things before, but this is just so pertinent to what we're talking about. So flee youthful passions and pursue righteousness, faith, love, and peace. That's a lot to pursue. Just think about that. But what a great collection of things to pursue in your relationship. Faith, love, peace, along with those who call on the Lord from a pure heart. In other words, one that's not bound up with personal interests, personal self-seeking motivations. Have nothing to do with foolish and ignorant controversies. You know that they breed quarrels. And the Lord's servant must not be quarrelsome, but kind to everyone. Able to teach, patiently enduring evil, correcting his opponents. And aren't we glad that he put that in there? He doesn't say, never speak up for what you believe is right. He doesn't say that. But look at the way that phrase is couched in with all the rest so that it demonstrates a clear respect. Correcting his opponents with gentleness. God may, perhaps, grant them repentance, leading to a knowledge of the truth. And they may come to their senses and escape from the snare of the devil after being captured by him to do his will. Now, I don't advise that you go home and tell your wife, well, obviously you've been captured by the devil to do his will, and that's why you think the way you do. I don't know if that would go well for you in the discussion, but what's the kinder principle that he's saying?
It's
It's a proverbial principle. A soft answer, a soft discussion, a thoughtful discussion may produce an understanding. But a reviling discussion, a discussion that casts doubt on the character or the intelligence of the other person, you ever called your wife's intelligence into question? I mean, maybe you didn't use those exact words, but it was pretty clear that you were. Or am I just the only person in this room that's ever done that?
Doesn't go well.
She's smart enough to understand that.
And in all honesty, isn't this what we want? That there would be a transforming of minds? A changing of hearts? And in the process of doing that, it might even be our own mind and our own heart that's transformed. But what he's saying, the ultimate thing here is that if you insist on bickering and fighting, all you do is force people further and deeper into their silo of resistance. And I think it's possible over a period of time to force people into positions that it's almost impossible for them to get back out. Like if you've spent years building up these walls, think about how long it's going to take to break them down. So here's the advice, and this advice is coming from several different writers. Don't do that. In the end, you're not going to accomplish anything that you wanted. And I know I've shared this story with you, and I chuckle at it every time I think about it. The friend of mine, whose wife looked at him one time, and they were in the middle of an argument, and she said to him, with a straight face and all sincerity, would you rather be right or would you rather be married? Now, who doesn't get that? And only a woman would say that. Because what would the man rather be? Well, I mean, he'd like to be both, but he certainly doesn't want to be wrong so he can be married, right? What man wants to be that?
And we're looking at scripturally here, Paul's talking to Timothy, and he knows about this thing called quarreling and conflict. You go back in his ministry when he was transformed, when he had already experienced, you know, the road to Damascus, and he's in the ministry, and he had a partner, Barnabas, and he knows all about this quarreling and conflict, because if you read, they parted ways. It was so strong.
Mm-hmm.
And he parted with John Mark, and the whole scenario of this division, and it was repaired later. But if you look at that, so he knows from experience how to do this the right way and the wrong way, how to do this godly and not godly.
So some of the unreasonable expectations that we set up for ourselves, and I think men and women are equally guilty of this. We expect that if the relationship is good, that conflicts aren't going to occur that are serious or large. And we love each other. Have you ever heard a young couple say this? We love each other, so it'll all work out.
Yeah.
You can be seriously in love with someone and seriously in disagreement with them at the same time. And if you doubt that with your wife, have a kid. Turn over to James, the 4th chapter, and we're just going to wrap this up with one final redoubling down on this. More familiar words. What causes quarrels and what causes fights among you? Is it not that your passions are at war within you? Now, we can stop right there and just, what is he saying? Because I care about something. And he's describing, I think, two things. If you look at this, this could apply two separate ways. Is it the quarrel between people, or is it at times even the things that war within each of us? Part of me knows the right thing to do or the right way to handle this, and another part of me knows what I would like to do. Part of me knows that I probably shouldn't buy this, but another part of me wants it. Part of me knows that I should come home and deal with something with my wife, and another part of me wants to stay at work and do something different. So first and foremost, there's a war going on inside myself about what is the best thing to do in this situation. And I'm going to interact with another person who has that same internal conflict going on. He should be home right now. Oh, but I know he needs to work. Whatever it is, I mean, create your own thing that you argue about all the time. Now, we assume that the other person doesn't have that internal conflict going on. But remember what conflict does? It raises walls and reduces trust. And so at the moment when that conflict is heated, that other party, your wife in this case, isn't going to acknowledge, yeah, there's a war going on inside of me at the same time. I understand your situation. And I experience my want. So two people, each with a conflict going on inside themselves, then have the conflict. Is it not that your passions are at war within you? You desire and you do not have, and so you murder. You covet and you cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. And it's almost as if what he's saying is, okay, if you can't get what you really want, the next best thing is to just have a great argument about it. It's like the consolation prize. I can't get the thing that I want, so what I'll do is have an argument with you and try to make you know how hard done I am and how wrong you are for not allowing me to have this. So maybe you'll relent, maybe not. But then he goes on to say, and you ask and do not receive because you ask wrongly to spend on your own passions. Now that's just, remember I said that we would do some reflective stuff this morning. At the heart of the disagreement that you and your spouse may be having, or you and somebody else may be having, do you genuinely believe that this is a core issue of right and wrong, or is it a personal preference? It's different all the time. But that's a very personal and reflective. And when can you make? I don't think at the heated moment of passion, you can even think about that. Because at the moment when you want what you want, you don't really want to think about, do I want this just because I want this, or do I want this because it's right? Because you're already so emotionally invested in it. This is where we come back to the principle of the sound mind. The sound mind says discernment at this point would be to say, I won't have the discussion at all because I'm too emotionally invested in wanting what I want. Maybe I shouldn't be the one to initiate this conversation right now because I know that my motives are not going to be right and I'm not going to do this the right way. Now think about this. Aren't there times when we just want to have an argument just because we want to get this? We're going to settle this and we're going to settle it right now. Nothing good comes after those words come out of your mouth. Well, I don't know. I'm just assuming. I know that not much good comes of something after I've said those words. Now, listen to the way he describes this next. Do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. So what he's saying is, at the moment when you allow your passions to override your God-given responsibility, you've now become God's enemy in that moment. Now that's an unsettling place to be. And I don't think any of us wakes up in the morning and says, yeah, I would like to be God's enemy today. But what he's saying is, you are working against kingdom of heaven interests and values at that moment. So at that moment, you've set yourself up as the enemy of God. Doesn't mean that's a permanent condition. But at that moment, you're working against the very things that God is trying to do. So I think that's where we're going to wrap this up. There's a few moments left for some group discussion if any of you has something you'd like to add.